Good morning. Welcome to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Your Toronto Blue Jays have won four in a row. Sometimes you score 13 runs. Sometimes you get 14 hits in every game over the course of a weekend series. Sometimes Reese McGuire runs into a game-ending double play for you. Sometimes you get outmatched by a young pitcher, so you got to win greasy. Jays won a little greasy yesterday, not the prettiest of games. Gavin Williams dominated the Blue Jays a couple times through the order. Every Blue Jay struck out against him at least once. He finished with 12 strikeouts over seven innings, just one hit and one walk allowed. He's actually the first Cleveland Guardians pitcher ever to strike out 12 while allowing one hit or fewer. Pretty good outing for Williams. The Jays continue to struggle with some of these guys who pound fastballs up in the zone. Now, Williams isn't quite what we've seen with some of these other struggles where guys are only throwing 92, 93, and it can get really frustrating. Williams, 95, 96, obviously, he's, like we set up at the end of yesterday's show, huge guy with great extension down the mound, so it kind of bursts out of his hand a little closer to the plate. Jays had a lot of trouble with that. Yet, they won this game in large part thanks to Kevin Biggio. Kevin Biggio comes through in the top of the eighth with a two-run home run off De Los Santos. Then, in the bottom of the eighth, comes up with a huge unassisted double play. Jimmy Garcia gotten in a little bit of trouble. Tim Meza comes in. Tim Meza, who has been better extinguishing inherited runners than any reliever in baseball this year. Tough lefty-on-lefty single from Bo Naylor. Great piece of hitting from the Canadian. That scores one. And then Tim Meza gets a ground ball. Kevin Biggio with the very heady unassisted double play, not just to pick up the double play, but to also chase down the runner, get the tag first, and keep the force on at first base rather than, you know, there's a scenario there where Biggio scoops the ball up, throws it to first, then they get the base runner in a rundown. They still get the double play, but because the force is off, the run's able to score. The run crosses home before the final out is tagged. And in that situation, the runner has every incentive to freeze and then get in a rundown and just extend it out as long as possible. But by Biggio tracking the runner, tagging him, and then running to first himself, keeps that possibility off by keeping the force on. So really nice play from Biggio following up the two-run home run. The team was obviously very fired up for Kevin and from Kevin. So nice to see him have a big moment like that in a season where, you know, it's at times felt like he's not a huge part of what this club is doing. And then Jordan Hicks comes on for the roller coaster that was that save would make every ride at Wonderland blush. It makes them all look like the Ghoster Coaster. 2-3-4 in the order, hits a batter, allows a single, and then walks a batter to load the bases, gets out of it. It was messy, but the Jays get it done. It's their fourth win in a row. They improved to 14 games over 500. They remain in the third wildcard spot, close the gap with Houston to just half a game, close the gap in the division to just seven games because the Baltimore Orioles were not in action yesterday. That does not mean the Baltimore Orioles did not take a big loss yesterday, though. If any of you were on social media or if any of you were watching broadcasts around baseball, you surely heard people talking about the fact that the Orioles have not suspended, air quotes, Kevin Brown, their play-by-play voice on the TV side. He hasn't been on broadcast in about a month because he read from the game notes that the Baltimore Orioles hadn't been very successful at Tropicana Field over the last couple of years. Baseball obviously rallying around Kevin Brown, as they should. I've gotten the pleasure of meeting Kevin and talking to him a few times when the Orioles are in town. Terrific guy, terrific at his job. The Orioles ownership just, they can't get out of their own way. This is a couple times now that Angelos has taken Baltimore's positive momentum as an on-field product and been like, hey, what if we put a bunch of negativity on me and my ownership and my fragile ego? This is not the first instance of that. Maybe it won't be the last. It does sound like, based on reporting from Britt Jaroli at The Athletic, that Kevin Brown will rejoin the Orioles broadcast this weekend. So I guess all's well that ends well. But it is frustrating from the perspective of someone who is in sports media. It's frustrating from the perspective of someone who is a baseball fan and enjoys Kevin Brown when I'm watching an Orioles broadcast. It's frustrating from the perspective of common sense and logic. Also just from a PR perspective, do you think people are going to forget that you tore the team down to the studs, paid nobody above the minimum, and were irredeemably bad for years? Part of the story of your team having success now is that you wiped everything out and cleared the deck. Like, you didn't just accidentally get all these high-end prospects. You didn't get them in the 20th round or 18th round or whatever and develop them. They are all high picks because you tore things down to the studs. And you're allowed to do that, but you're not allowed to erase the history. Like, you can't Men in Black everyone and be like, well, don't ever mention that, you know, we had a rough time the last couple of years. On top of which, like, it wasn't even like he was like, oh, this team was so, so bad the last couple of years. No, he just read out the record at Tropicana Field. And I know there are some people who jump to, well, and I think this is outside of how they're treating Kevin. The biggest point of frustration for me is that there are some people who assume all sports media are silenced in some way. And that's obviously not the case. I mean, if you watch a Jays broadcast, Dan Shulman, Joe Siddle, Buck Martinez, Caleb Joseph, everyone is pretty straightforward when, hey, the Blue Jays are one of the 10 worst OPSs of all time hitting with runners in scoring position. What are you going to do about that? It is a constant story year over year of how the Blue Jays struggle at the Trop. Yes, you have to operate within the guidelines of what is reasonable and what is fair, but man, the taking a guy off the air because he referenced the record a team had against an opponent the last couple of years is beyond insane. The Orioles at the ownership level doing everything they can to make sure the good vibes that they have on the field are just not carried over and no one's rooting for that ownership group to succeed. Anyway, maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more throughout the show. We do have a loaded show, so maybe not. John Morosi is going to join us in a little bit. Madison Shipman of Sportsnet and Blue Jay Central joins us in the 11 o'clock hour. Andre Knott of Bally Sports Cleveland will come on. And the big one at 11 o'clock, Alex Anthopoulos will join us. Jose Bautista is going into Level of Excellence this weekend. We'll talk to Alex Anthopoulos about that and about his world-beating Braves. Right now, though, we've got to get an injury report from down in Cleveland. It's Keegan Mathison of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. Big spot last night. Bases loaded, 2-2 count, two out, bottom of the ninth. And Keegan, your laptop takes one for the team. How is she doing today?
Still humming, baby. It is still going. That is the most impressed I have ever been with a piece of technology. And baseballs into the press box are a bit of a hazard in our job. I still remember a few years back, I believe it was one of our Sportsnet friends got a baseball off the laptop, but it was one of those black plastic Dell laptops, and there was shrapnel. It looked like a grenade had gone off in the press box. It was everywhere. But yeah, this ball came back. It was a 102 pitch, foul ball straight back into the press box, right off of the MacBook. Blake, I almost wish that I was using some small brand laptop. Like, I'm not going to get a sponsorship from Apple. They've got bigger fish to fry, you know? But a nice dent and ball mark right next to the logo. And I feel connected to this laptop now. You know, we've been through something together. Fell off the desk, big fire sale, everything was flying around. Still going, still working. So at least one of us is holding up physically through this part of the season.
Well, I'm glad it worked out there. The Rocchio foul ball, and then of course Jordan Hicks picks it up from there after your laptop's big assist. And on a night where all the focus was on him, Kevin Biggio showed real concern for you. That had to be a nice little moment. Kevin Biggio, you know, home run, unassisted double play, and he's like, no, let's make sure Keegan's all right first.
That's right. Kevin walked out for his post-game scrum, and just as we were getting ready to ask our questions, myself, Arden, and then Dave Singh from Sportsnet, he looked up and said, Keegs, was that your laptop? And my initial thought, Blake, was, oh, my God, I hope that wasn't on the broadcast. But thankfully, he was, as any locked-in baseball player is, from second base, looking up into the press box. And I'm sure a couple of the Blue Jays had a chuckle at that, and I probably had an opportunity to make a play, Blake, but it's about weighing the risks. And you know what? If I try to make that play and botch it, and then I have to walk into that clubhouse every day for the next 45 or 50 days, not worth it. So I made a split decision. You know, there's a lot of MacBooks. There's only one right hand on my body, and it's very valuable for typing. So let the technology take the hit like a coward.
Nah, that's fine. I made a similar business decision at Christie Pitts this weekend where I could have made a play on a foul ball, but it would have, you know, could have risked half a beer. It could have, you know, that slope on that hill, you stand up with a foot half asleep. Maybe you take a header. Wasn't worth it. So before we get to the actual injury from last night, let's stay on Kevin Biggio because he does have this big eighth inning. I think you called it the best 15 minutes of his season in your write-up at BlueJays.com. He hits a two-run home run. Then he comes out and makes that really heady play on the unassisted double play. The home run speaks for itself, but that double play, and I don't even know how much of this is like conscious thought in the moment or is just you've played so much baseball and thought about baseball so much, but the way he handled that double play to make sure the force stayed on and make sure that run at home couldn't come across. Did Kevin talk about that at all? Did John Schneider talk about that at all? Or do we just assume that was, you know, pure baseball instinct?
Yeah, he got a lot of love for that. And Blake, what it very oddly reminded me of, there was that viral clip last year of NFL wide receiver Cooper Kupp breaking down a play on a touchdown. And it went viral on Twitter because he was speaking in what, to me, was gibberish. You know, I was looking for the X, Y open seam, Y banana, blah, blah, blah. It didn't make sense. But it was such an elevated level of thinking. And hearing Kevin break down why he was positioned there, how he reacted to the play, was one of those moments where I stand back and think, you know what, I think I know this game. I don't. At a level that these players do, not close. And John Schneider's comment was that that was probably the last scenario they would ever plan for. But when you hear teams droning on and on about preparing for every single thing, yeah, that's what they're talking about eventually. Sometimes you see it. And a game like yesterday is who Biggio can be. You're not going to get that every day, of course, but if he is OPSing in the high 600s with the odd home run, reaching base a bit, but making those smart plays, that's where his value is as a big league player. That's the type of play that will help him stick in this league another 10 years if he keeps that up, is his ability to make the right play at the right time in a way that is so prepared. Now, preparation isn't sexy. We don't have a metric for it. We don't talk about it. But that's what it looks like when it finally pays off. And we haven't seen that all the time from Biggio this year. I think everyone knows that. There have been, even on the bases, a couple of instances where he has not shown to be the very good base runner I believe he truly is. But the way he's handled all of this, I do admire. You know, you've got Whit Merrifield in there. You have Santiago Espinal dealing with some reps at second base. Then Davis Schneider shows up, and he's the second baseman. Meanwhile, Kevin Biggio has taken this all in stride. I really respect how he has. And he's a fascinating baseball mind. He is probably the most interesting conversation I have on this team, and very good to see him showing that on the field. Has not been the case all year. I think we've seen that, but that's such an example of what his brain is capable of.
And it's something that, like you said, it's hard to quantify. It's also hard to put yourself in that position where, you know, a couple times over these last few years, it's looked like maybe you were breaking out as an everyday player, but you've kind of settled into that level of, and this year he's been a pure bench player, but over the last couple of years, it's like, yeah, well, we're fine if you're there, but we'd love to upgrade that spot. That can't be an easy position to be in from an ego perspective. And I wonder, Keegan, how much a couple of moments like that, and we saw Kevin with the kind of the yell, or I think you called it a howl in your piece as he went to the dugout after the double play. The team obviously, and John Schneider especially, obviously very fired up for him. The value of a guy like that in the room who can accept a role like that, even if, look, I'm almost positive if Kevin Biggio were being completely honest with you, he'd tell you that, hey, I think I could play better if I were playing every day and getting regular plate appearances. I think probably every player in baseball would tell you that. But a guy who can handle that role and still tick off the boxes as, you know, the good teammate and the communicator and things like that, I wonder when you see Biggio have a night like that, coming off a weekend where every bit of boost was Davis Schneider, you know, did that kind of roll into, well, now Kevin's the guy giving a little shot in the arm to the room because those guys are pulling for him too?
Yeah, there needs to be somebody. And there's a reason that Biggio has stuck on this roster, even at times where the numbers don't point in that direction. I know the numbers have not been good. I know what high velocity fastballs do to Biggio when they're up in the zone. I see these issues that he faces at the plate. They're obvious, and that's why it's often such a big discussion point among Blue Jays fans, among analysts. It makes sense. But I also know how the Blue Jays talk about Kevin Biggio internally, which is why I will always say, yes, this is bad, but he's going to stick around. This organization loves Biggio. He's kind of in that Danny Jansen bracket of just having a lot of fans within the organization for everything he does around the field, off the field, game planning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, which matters. Again, not things that we talk about. It's not a home run total or an OPS that you can measure. And you know, believe me, the things you can measure do matter a bit more here, but everything else Biggio does is so impressive. And I think I've said before that if the Blue Jays could put Biggio's brain in every player, that would be a win. Like he is such an advanced thinker of the game and has such a good feel for it, obviously from his upbringing and being around it. But I think that if you can get, you know, you're not going to get a home run and a star defensive play every night. That's all right. But if you get some sort of regular contribution, then once or twice a week, you're going to get a play like that defensive play that makes you say, oh, that's worth it. This is why Biggio is in the lineup. So it's going to be tough for him to keep that going with Schneider there, with Whit Merrifield, Santiago Espinal. There are challenges, there are hurdles, but he needs to be part of the Blue Jays' success, and I think yesterday was a reminder of what that can look like in a part-time, sometimes role.
And hey, look, in the modern baseball offensive environment, a 691 OPS is actually not that far off from being, you know, roughly average. He's got a WRC plus of 92, so about 8% worse than a league average hitter when we control for a bunch of factors. So it's not like he's, you know, too far off from, you know, being a pretty capable bench contributor with the bat as well. Curious, Keegan, before we close out the Cavan note, this is maybe looking a little bit too far ahead because, you know, the update you and Arden provided from down in Cleveland yesterday is that, you know, Bo's not even hitting yet. We'll see if he gets to that stage in the next day or two back here in Toronto. But assuming Davis Schneider is some semblance of solid still and Bo Bichette returns, you know, there's going to be a tough decision with respect to Biggio, Espinal, Schneider on this 26-man roster. Do you get the sense that it's a Biggio versus Espinal thing right now, or is that going to depend entirely on, you know, how long Davis Schneider can keep up the fairy tale here?
Yeah, this will be an interesting one. And Blake, just to what you said about the 691 OPS and where he fits in this league, I mean, look at Cleveland's lineup. I mean, there are worse options than Kevin Biggio in Major League Baseball. My goodness. Now, the next few weeks, I think, or no, I shouldn't say few weeks, I'm not putting timelines on this, but the coming days, as we see where Bo Bichette is going to be lining up for a potential comeback, right now he is hoping to start swinging a bat and doing some hitting the next couple of days. Picture Bo Bichette's swing loading up on that back right leg. So that is going to test his knee. This is not just standing still. That's really going to test him. But if this is another week or two, we'll see. Now, if Davis Schneider falls off this next week, which I'm not exactly expecting, but if that happens, easy. He's the new guy back to AAA, and you come into 2024 looking for him to be part of the team. But if this comes down to Biggio and Espinal, I think this is something where Espinal is on that roster bubble, potentially. Coming into the year, I really liked Espinal's role on this team, and he has looked better lately. I want to give him credit for that. But looked like a guy who would line up to just mash lefties, play 80 or 90 games like a reserve player does now, but really match up offensively in situations that were beneficial to him. We just didn't see that through the first few months of the season, and that's been tough. I think another player who is dealing with not everyday reps, trying to stay fresh, trying to stay involved. But this is another good problem for the Blue Jays, and it's one at a position where they're starting to develop a little more talent. They do have some waves of talent coming in that infield. Finally, developing position players has not been exactly an identity of this team for years now, but they're finding themselves in some good problems that good teams have.
So with respect to Davis Schneider, I know he's a name you and I have actually talked about on this show for the bulk of the season as someone who is rising up. You know, I know you don't do an official ranking, but he seemed to be on your radar and moving upward. It's a very good reminder that, hey, all the little things matter. Some guy getting hot at age 24, even though he was Rule 5 unprotected, having a hot start at AAA, everything like this matters in baseball. You know, there's going to be a weekend where you need a boost. There's going to be someone hurt and you need to fill in. All of this stuff is important. Now, I know you've also been a guy who, you know, has had your eyes on Davis Schneider a little bit more than the average person. We saw yesterday, and look, Gavin Williams was getting a lot of strikeouts on everyone. Literally everyone in the Blue Jays lineup got struck out by Gavin Williams at least once. But Schneider did swing and miss on four fastballs high in the zone over his first two plate appearances. Is that something that is in the book on Schneider, or was that just a particularly tough Gavin Williams game for Davis Schneider?
Yeah, these things don't happen by accident, for sure. And yesterday, Gavin Williams was so good, I will write that one off for most of the Blue Jays lineup. But where he was locating with that velocity and movement, so impressive. That was scary. But for Davis Schneider, when he comes up, let's think of this game one and game two in Boston. If you are Boston's starting pitcher, you're not exactly dedicating an hour of time pregame to Davis Schneider. You probably don't care all that much. You're looking at Vladdy. You're looking at Matt Chapman. You're looking at big names you've heard of before. Not a guy coming up from AAA who is, right now, I think our number 28 prospect. He's going to jump up to be, spoiling the release a bit, but 13 or 14 range on our updated list coming soon. You're not going to spend a lot of time on that. Well, if you are Cleveland, you just saw what he did, a historic series to start his career. Now you're going to pay attention. Now you're going to say, okay, let's talk to our AAA guys. Let's see what the scouting report is on this guy. He's going to start getting game planned against. That's the one drawback from coming in hot. You start to get game planned against. And we see that in broader strokes. We see it in shorter strokes, that it's a game of adjustments back and forth. So now, if that is what Cleveland is going to target against Davis Schneider, does he look for that today? It's his turn now. He has been beaten, so it's his turn to adjust back. And that's the difference between guys who are good for a week and guys who stick around.
It's a tough one, and we'll see. Obviously, he has a great sense of the strike zone. None of the high heat that he swung and missed at were outside the zone, so at least he's not chasing. But yeah, that'll be something to watch here. Okay, Keegan, off the top, we joked around about your laptop being the most serious injury from yesterday, bearing the lead a little bit here. Hyunjin Ryu goes four hitless innings, only surrendering one walk, strikes out two, but has to come out of the game because he takes a comebacker off the inside of his right knee, is still able to make the play and get the out at first base, but comes out of the game, underwent precautionary x-rays last night, which we'll get an update on from you pregame on Twitter, I'm sure. And for anyone who was wondering about just the timeline there, Ryu said through the translator after the game that it was the ball off the knee that hurt him when he kind of fell after the play to first base. It wasn't something he did running or making the play. Keegan, what was your sense of optimism or pessimism from the team, from John Schneider, from Hyunjin Ryu after the game on what the status of that knee is?
Well, it looked terrible. It looked like he blew his knee, period. It looked like his season was over and that it was going to be the cruelest, most heartbreaking injury we've seen in a while for the Blue Jays. But sounds much better. Now, better is relative. I'm sure Ryu would not consider this to be feeling good or better right now, but it is just the contusion, ideally, that the Blue Jays are looking at. Now, as long as these x-rays come back negative, which the Blue Jays are optimistic they will, then this is going to be a matter of pain and, by the sounds of it, a hell of a lot of swelling in Ryu's knee. Now, this is his landing knee. So as he drives to the plate, this is the one that he puts down and spins through his delivery on. There's a lot of stress put on that knee. So in terms of getting that swelling down, the inflammation, ideally he'll be able to keep his arm fresh and throwing a bit throughout this, but this does not look like a quick thing. I don't expect him to be pitching. I think Sunday it would line up against the Cubs back in Toronto. That seems pretty far-fetched at this point. So we've said for a while now, Blake, that the six-man rotation would eventually need to shorten up. And I do always hate that saying of things figure themselves out, because you are kind of not wishing injuries on anyone, but you're accepting the realities of Major League Baseball, that it happens eventually. Certainly at this time of year, when guys are wearing down around the league, you start to see more. Unfortunately, it came for Ryu, who was such a good story. He nailed that Tommy John recovery. He did such an incredible job with that. Came back looking great and looked really good pitching through those first four innings. So hopefully for him, this is just something that takes a couple of weeks to manage and get the swelling down. And if that's the case, then he's an option down the stretch again, because once again, injuries happen and you want to have a guy of Ryu's caliber there and ready. So not as bad as it looked initially, but still not comfortable. Not something I'd want to happen to me. Let's classify it as that.
No, and, you know, John Schneider joking about the size of his calves. Well, yeah, it doesn't protect you if you get hit on the knee. Sad news for us big-calved people who were hoping that was some protection. You mentioned the six-man rotation thing. So, yeah, it's, you know, you say Kikuchi's going to go tonight. You could just start him on normal rest on the Sunday in the spot that would have been Ryu's turn up, and then you've got three off days over a stretch of 8 days once you're through this stretch. So, you know, this is a case where, yeah, the Dan Shulmanism of these things have a way of working themselves out, just not the way you want to here. Just one last one on Ryu, Keegan. You mentioned he nailed the Tommy John rehab. He looked so good yesterday. I loved the paraphrased point from Kevin Biggio in your write-up from last night, that even when Ryu was missing yesterday, he was missing where he wanted to miss and not missing to bad and dangerous spots. Man, I guess just, obviously we all hope we see him again and the x-rays are negative and he just needs a little bit of time here. How impressed are you by Ryu's ability? Like, I know there are people who say, you know, the cutter's the last thing to come back, or the precise command is the last thing to come back, but it really does feel like Ryu, with the changeup going yesterday, like, velocity being two ticks down is really the only box left he had to tick.
Yeah, he just needs to get another 1.5 miles an hour, which does matter quite a bit for where he is, but you still have to be optimistic that can come. But like Kevin said, his misses being where he wanted them to be is so important. And if you're listening, that means if Ryu is trying to throw outside on a right-handed hitter, let's say, so outside, instead of missing out over the plate, he's missing further outside, away from the danger. And that's so important for Ryu, because if you miss out over the plate and you're throwing 89, goodbye, you're done. That's end of story. You're going to be hit hard. We saw a bit of that in his first outing. A lot of that contact was really, really, really hard. That was scary for a bit for Ryu. But looked so much better yesterday against the Guardians. And that changeup got five or six swings and misses, which is so important for him, and was pitching very efficiently as well. He does such a good job of recognizing when a hitter is revved up wanting to hit a fastball and throwing that change up and making them look foolish. It's not quite to the Gausman splitter level. I don't think many pitches are, but you can still see him fooling hitters, which at the major league level is so impressive. So looked very good, and ideally, hopefully for him as a person, that this injury doesn't keep him out so long that he can't keep that momentum going and keep throwing.
Yeah, we have to hope, and, you know, a couple days and then maybe, hey, one tune-up down at AAA. And I wonder, too, if they be extra patient just because rosters expand in a couple weeks here, and that saves you from making a tough and complicated decision if you can stretch it out a couple extra days. But obviously, first and foremost, is Ryu's health here. Keegan, health of your laptop, in good shape. What is the fill from here to 3 o'clock? Because I know Cleveland is not your favorite city on the beat. Is it just back to bed here?
You know what? Yeah, it's the luxurious life on the road. And I'm sure somebody likes Cleveland. It's just not me. But yeah, there's going to be a little bit of wandering around the hotel room. I'll see what the other side of it looks like. Maybe I'll look out one of these windows and see what's on the roof next to me again. But then at 1 p.m. Eastern, we have a Zoom with Jose Bautista. So it's the Zoom itself, you know, gives me that anxiety from COVID era. I can still picture that raise hand button that gives me nervous. But We'll have some stories coming on Jose Bautista ahead of his Level of Excellence induction, I think, coming this Saturday. So Joey Bats is back.
This Saturday it is, and we'll talk to Alex Anthopoulos here on this show around 11 about some of his Jose Bautista memories. We'll have a couple guests throughout the week to talk Joey Bats. Keegan Matheson, thanks so much for the time this morning, buddy, and very, very glad you and the laptop are okay after the ninth inning scare.
Hey, you got it, brother. Take care.
Keegan Matheson of MLB.com, of BlueJays.com. His little story and the picture of his laptop damage actually just got retweeted by John Morosi. So natural pivot to John Morosi joining us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Dive deep into Toronto sports and the NFL. The J.D. Bunkus Podcast. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays win a fourth in a row last night. They continue to expand their lead over the rest of the wild card field. They're now three games up on Seattle, who are the closest behind them, five up on Boston, eight up on the Angels, who keep finding new and worse ways to lose, and five and a half games up on the New York Yankees, who lost a tough one yesterday that included an absolute meltdown from Aaron Boone, a friend of our next guest, John Morosi of MLB Network. John, good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Blake. It has been a very interesting month of August already around the major leagues. My goodness, these pennant races, wild card races, we've got a very thrilling conclusion to the season ahead, I think.
We sure do. Your guy, Aaron Boone, yesterday wearing it a little bit, showing that frustration. Of course, Laz Diaz, the home plate umpire, was not having a very good game from a balls and strike perspective. But for a Yankees team that just lost Domingo Germán, just lost Anthony Rizzo, now may have lost Carlos Rodon as well, Aaron Boone's little meltdown as part of his ejection yesterday, how much do you think that is just kind of everything snowballing on the Yankees the last little bit here?
Well, that's exactly what it is. And Aaron, in my experience, is one of the most patient managers in baseball. I think he's done an admirable job of keeping things as well as he can, at least on a straight trajectory for this team, because they have been, to your point, beset by injuries and other kind of issues that they've experienced on and off the field during the course of the year. They're still above 500, albeit barely. They are the last place team right now in the American League East. And I agree. I mean, every interaction I've had with Aaron this year, even as this team has struggled, he has been totally calm and in his usual good humor, will still make a joke and have light moments in conversation. But let's not forget, this is an intense competitor who's feeling the stress of one of the more stressful jobs in professional sports, which is managing the New York Yankees. And to your point, nothing has been going right. You've got Rizzo on the IL, and no one knows when he's going to come back with post-concussion issues. Germán obviously has entered alcohol rehab. Last night they lose a game where they really can't get any offense going, and they've got their ace on the mound in Gerrit Cole. And when he doesn't win, it seems the Yankees don't ever win, and that's where they're at right now. I think their postseason odds right now, Blake, are down under 10%, and it feels that way. It feels there's just no path right now for them to make it to October. And obviously, they can change that with a good run of form for a couple of weeks. But for fans of the Yankees that have been watching this team and waiting for them to turn it around, it hasn't happened. And I think that we're seeing now the coming and going of the lineup and players in and out and Judge missing the amount of time that he missed. It's just not their year, Blake. That's the simplest that I can say. And now we have to consider what this means for the rest of the American League East and probably even further down the line what it means for the future leadership of the Yankees and the club and what they're going to do this offseason. But this year right now, Blake, seems to be going nowhere fast for the New York Yankees.
And they're five and a half back of a wild card spot now. Obviously, the division is long gone. When you look back, John, and look, this last week has been tough, and that informs the playoff odds a little bit. You know, you drop three of four here after splitting with the Rays the last couple games, kind of right around the trade deadline there, or lost two or three to the Rays, rather. you know, some of that is informed by what's happened the last week, but they were in a similar spot at the deadline, as were the Red Sox, who have kind of spiraled since they started that West Coast trip at the end of July. Both of those teams now sitting five and a half games out of the playoffs, with playoff odds both down around 10%. When you look at the relative lack of activity for both of those teams at the trade deadline, the Red Sox adding, you know, a depth infielder, the Yankees adding a nice reliever in Keenan Middleton, but not really a needle mover. Were you surprised that neither of those teams pulled the trigger on being modest sellers instead of fortifying what they have here?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that a couple things I would point out. Number one, different from when the Yankees were sellers in 2016, when they traded both Chapman and Miller, that to me was, first of all, different playoff rules back then. There were fewer playoff spots to compete for. And that roster was more in clear need of a reboot. And they also had better pieces to move. In terms of, at the end of the day, if you're not in it and if you've got relievers, that's usually the time to move them, is at the deadline. That's when they're at their most valuable. Right now, when you look at the Yankees roster in particular, I'm not sure who they would have moved that you would have said has peak value right now. You know, maybe an arm. They're not going to trade Gerrit Cole. Their bullpen, I suppose you could have moved Clay Holmes. And look, the Seattle Mariners, I think, showed the world that when they moved Paul Sewald, and they've played really well since then, you can trade a reliever and still have a good run. The Brewers basically did that last year with Hader. The Mariners are doing that right now. So that's maybe the one critique I would have, is why not trade a Clay Holmes and see what you can get for him? That's a reasonable take. But I think they felt like they were somewhat stuck, close enough to being a playoff team, but not really far enough away that you would consider selling. I think that was probably the calculus in some ways of the Red Sox as well. Although they had, I think, in Paxton, maybe a little bit of a better near-term piece that they could have moved, and they opted against it. The Verdugo situation, where he was benched over the weekend, that maybe wasn't as foreseen as other things. I mean, that's a significant concern. I mean, he's one of their core guys right now. When you think about the way he arrived in the Mookie Betts deal, I mean, this is someone that they need to count on, and he's been a little inconsistent. And that to me is a red flag for this team, to see what they're going to be able to do going forward. So was I surprised that they both did not sell? Not necessarily, but I also look at their rosters and say, with the exception of a couple rental pieces, they didn't have a whole lot of guys to move. And that is a fairly strong indictment of where they're at right now in this division, where I think there's a clear top three. And remarkably, in the American League East, that top three does not and probably will not include the Yankees and Red Sox this season.
The top three in the American League East, of course, being Baltimore, Tampa Bay, and Toronto. Also two pretty darn good teams in the West, in Texas and Houston, two teams that were very aggressive in trying to fortify, certainly the two most aggressive teams in the American League at the deadline. John, when you look at the top of the American League right now, how would you tier it? Do you have any of those, you know, Baltimore, Tampa, Texas, Houston, do you have any of them a step ahead of the others? Do you think the Blue Jays belong in with that group, or kind of a second tier of their own? How do you see the American League right now post-deadline?
Yes, great question. I do think Baltimore is the best all-around club in the American League. Just athleticism, their pitching, that they got Flaherty, who I think will help them out a lot in the postseason, will certainly be a huge part of their playoff rotation. I like their bullpen. They've got two significant arms at the end of the game there in Bautista and Cano. I like this roster. I think they're athletic. They probably could have added a little bit more pitching at the deadline and didn't. But in general, I really like this team a lot. And I'm a big fan of teams that come up playing together and have that chemistry that you see, where they're all invested in each other's success. It's a really refreshing way to watch the game. I think the world of what they're doing. I think Tampa is still an excellent ball club. And now my concern with their rotation and McClanahan and injuries that they've gone through, that to me is a little bit of a worry. But in general, I still like Tampa, but I put Tampa a bit behind where Baltimore is. I think Toronto, look, that was a huge win last night in Cleveland. And And to have Ryu leave the game early after taking the comebacker to his knee, that was certainly a concerning development. But I thought Jay Jackson came in and threw great. He's been a godsend for this team. The bullpen in general covering five innings and doing a brilliant job of it. Biggio having a huge night. You know, that's one of those defining wins where you really have to dig deep and come back on a quality bullpen the way they did last night. So I think the Jays have proven themselves to be, so far, a good team. Not a great team, but a good team. And one that, in the current balance of power in the American League, should be able to hold on to a playoff spot. I will caution that Seattle has been playing as well as anybody for the last 6 weeks or so. I think they're a really good ball club. And, you know, they're playing out west. Sometimes they don't get the attention they deserve. They had the Jared Kelnick injury, which we weren't sure what that was going to be for them for the balance of the season. But I think they've played tremendously well. And what makes them scary for me, if I'm a Jays fan, is just how good their pitching is every single game. Their rotation 1-5 is arguably the best in the American League, and they've been relatively healthy for them. So they're going to have chances to keep winning series and winning series and winning series. And that's a long way of saying the Jays cannot assume that anybody is going to recede from their rearview mirror. The Jays have to keep playing really good baseball. They're not going to be able to back into the playoffs. If they try to back in, then I think Seattle's going to pass them by. I believe that much in what the Mariners are doing, and I think it's going to be a tremendous race to the finish there between Toronto and Seattle, more than likely for that third and final wild card spot.
Yeah, I think you're right. Seattle's playing. I mean, obviously, you go and you take four off of the Angels, who were aggressive at the deadline in adding and doing everything they can to make sure they make the playoffs in Shohei Ohtani's walk year. Those were about as high leverage of games as you can get here in early August, and the Mariners wiped the floor with the Angels. The Angels playoff odds, you referenced them for the Yankees and Red Sox earlier, down under 2% now per Fangraphs. John, when you look ahead to what this winter is going to be like, obviously Shohei Ohtani headlines the market, and then there is a ocean-sized gap before you get to the rest of the free agent crop. I guess just what do you make of how things have gone for the Angels and how that might affect, you know, how we're talking about the chances of Shohei Ohtani staying there if there was much of a chance in the first place?
Well, I think that the chances have diminished significantly just because of their struggles to try to get into the playoffs right now. I think if they were on their way to the playoffs, and if the Angels could, as part of their sales pitch to Shohei this wintertime, say, look, we made it to the playoffs. You were a huge reason why. Come back, and we can keep building on the success that we've had this year. You just can't say that unless there's a miracle in the next 6 weeks. And by the way, to back up for a moment, I think that by the time they got to the end of July, that they made the right decision to keep him, because it was at least worth a shot to try to make a run at this thing. If you could wind back the clock and trade him a year ago, that's probably when they should have traded him, but they didn't. The franchise was up for sale at the time, so there's a lot of extenuating circumstances there. I just think that he's going to have to go somewhere. All he's said, Blake, consistently in the last couple of years, I want to win, I need to win, I need to go somewhere that I can win. That's what he said all the time. And everybody that's going to offer him a contract is going to be in it for $500 million or thereabouts. And so if it's the Dodgers, and the Dodgers, they're about to make the playoffs now for their 11th straight season, they're going to be able to say, listen, Shohei, we've been there every single year in the playoffs. We do nothing but win the division every year, with the one exception being when they won 106 games and the Giants won 107. So they're just that good all the time. Oh, by the way, we're also in Southern California. Look at our amazing heritage of international players, from Nomo to everybody around the world, so many different countries. It's the perfect sales pitch. This is their DNA as a franchise. And I'd be stunned if he went anywhere that wasn't the Dodgers, or potentially if there's that the Seattle Mariners pitch is really good because it's West Coast and they've got a really up-and-coming team. You know, Shohei is a very smart baseball guy. He sees, he plays, he understands the dynamics of this league. And look at the Angels team. The other high-profile superstars right now are both on the IL. Rendon has been injured almost every single season that he's been with the Angels. So at what point in time do you expect things to just change? And there's not a lot of evidence there that it will. And so I think as a result, the chances of Shohei staying in Anaheim have dwindled along with the Angels' playoff odds here this season.
The Dodgers sales pitch, like you said, is pretty straightforward. I know you were down for that Dodgers-Padres series for MLB Network this weekend. When you look at that team, this year's version of the Dodgers, of course, one of the very best teams in baseball, winning percentage that's right near the top, a run differential that's second only to the Atlanta Braves in the National League. I'm actually talking to Alex Anthopoulos on the show around 11 o'clock today. John, when you look at where the Dodgers are and the amount of space that the Braves have been able to put between themselves and everyone else, how close do you see that race in the National League? And is there even a third team that should be in that discussion? Or is it, hey, Braves and the Dodgers trying to catch up to them?
To me, if the NLCS is not the Braves and Dodgers, it's an upset. Now, certainly, that can happen. We've seen it many times where teams that look like prohibitive favorites, you go back to the Phillies of 2010, where they were expected to make it to the World Series again and with one of the great rotations ever, and they didn't. The Tigers had a rotation in 2014 that included pitchers who are nothing but Cy Young winners, 1 through 5, and they got swept. So surprises can happen, but my point is this is as clear of a 1-2 scenario in terms of favorites as I can recall in a league since probably the heyday of the Red Sox-Yankees rivalry. I mean, it's that apparent to me. And you've got everything from a tremendous MVP debate between Acuna and even his own teammate, Matt Olson, and then Freddie and Mookie on the Dodgers side. I mean, you've got superstars everywhere. And I think with the Dodgers, you know, from talking to Dave Roberts yesterday, that the Dodgers' outstanding manager, who, by the way, is going to go 8-for-8 this year with making it to the playoffs every single year that he's managed the team. That's pretty great, Blake. He's a great manager. He talked about the unselfish nature of his superstars and the way that Freddie Freeman leads, the way that Mookie leads. It's unique that when you look at a team like this, the Dodgers, they've got this amazing budget. They can play on any superstar they want, and certainly can with Shohei in the offseason, but they are able to bring along their own players, like James Outman, who had a tremendous game yesterday, their own young superstar potential players, and then selectively spend on the guys they really want and that fit their culture. Freeman fits their culture. Mookie fits their culture, and in fact, they both accentuate the culture by how they lead. So I've just been thoroughly impressed by the Dodgers, what a professional group they are. You look at Jason Hayward, he comes back, a career renaissance for him this season. He's back with Freddie Freeman. They were, of course, teammates in Atlanta 13 years ago. There's a lot of really fun storylines here. And then on the Braves side, I think it'll be really interesting, I'm sure, for you to talk to Alex about just how they put this team together, because Alex has known when to sign guys on really good contracts, whether it's Olson, Sean Murphy, Ozzie Albies before that, Acuna in the past, Michael Harris. He just knows that this is a place that players want to play. And Austin Riley is one more name. You know, he's someone that we talked about enough. They've got superstars all over the place. And my favorite thing about the Braves, Blake, is that their players, their 9 position players, they are the 9 position players of any group that's in Major League Baseball with the most collective plate appearances among your main 9 guys. They play and they post every day. They're not having to switch guys out for platoon reasons as much. Their core players play. They're durable. They're available. They don't duck a tough assignment. They are in there all the time. And that, to me, is one of the coolest things that you see in baseball. This is a sport, as you know, Blake, that prizes showing up every day and being accountable and in the lineup every day. And there is no team in baseball that better embodies that ethic than the Atlanta Braves.
No, they've got 2 guys on the bench right now that haven't played in a week. That's how infrequently they need to turn to their bench. Other than, you know, Sean Murphy, obviously, as a catcher, isn't going to play every single day. And then Eddie Rosario occasionally getting the day off for Kevin Pillar. It's pretty remarkable. John Morosi of MLB Network, thanks so much for taking the time out this morning, man. I really appreciate it.
Blake, I really enjoyed the conversation. You do a great job on the show, and please give my best regards to Alex as well. There's usually one time a year where I try to speak French with him in an interview, and I usually get through a few sentences, but that's about all I got. So he's very patient, though, with my efforts there.
I will pass on a bonjour to Alex Anthopoulos for you,
very
John.
Very good. Please do. He'll laugh at that. I like that. Thank you.
Thanks so much. John Morosi of MLB Network, as I just mentioned, and we're kicking around there. Alex Anthopoulos coming up next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Breaking down the biggest stories in Toronto sports, The Fan Morning Show with Ailish Forfar and Justin Cuthbert. Subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. If you're down at the ballpark this Saturday, Chicago Cubs are in town, by the way. Jose Bautista is going to be honored in the Blue Jays level of excellence on Saturday. That's August 12th. That will be going down 3 o'clock start, but the special edition of Blue Jay Central will begin at 2:30. You'll want to get down there early, of course. The first 20,000 fans at the park will receive a Jose Bautista bat flip bobblehead. There will be exclusive specialty merchandise and items honoring Bautista's career available at Jay's shop. And then, of course, the level of excellence itself. Jose Bautista will go up there. He will join George Bell, Dave Steeb, Joe Carter, Cito Gaston, Tony Fernandez, Pat Gillick, Tom Cheek, Paul Beeston, Carlos Delgado, and Roy Halladay. Should be a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to go back and look at. Obviously, the most recent vintage of Jose Bautista memories come from the 2015 and 2016 seasons where the Toronto Blue Jays made the playoffs. There's, of course, the bat flip game. But there were also a couple of really fun Jose Bautista years before the Toronto Blue Jays got good to that level. Now, you go back to a time when Alex Anthopoulos was the assistant general manager of this team, and they acquire Jose Bautista late in the 2008 season. It's a post-waiver trade move for a player to be named later that ends up being Robinson Diaz. And he's not particularly great down the stretch there. Even in 2009, he's still kind of just a guy. Ends up with a 757 OPS that year, which that season was about league average. But late in the year, he starts to turn it on. So late in 2009, you're getting a glimpse. Is this just a random September hot streak? Is something clicking here? Well, lo and behold, what would happen in 2010 and beyond? Joining us now, the assistant general manager when the Toronto Blue Jays acquired Jose Bautista. He's now the general manager and president of baseball operations for the Atlanta Braves. It's Alex Anthopoulos. Alex, good morning.
Good morning, guys.
How you doing? I was just on with John Morosi, and he asked me to pass along a bonjour.
Oh, yeah, he loves to speak French, any chance he gets.
He sure does. He sure does. Okay, so, Alex, before we get in, I do want to talk a little Jose Bautista stuff with you, but your Braves are top of the National League right now. I know things are going pretty well, 70 and 40, a couple losses in a row here, but still, you know, best run differential in baseball, best record in baseball. What do you think has gone into things clicking at the level they have for your Atlanta Braves so far this year?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not paying attention, but it's actually three in a row that we've lost, not two, but I'll take the two. But now, look, we've gotten off to a nice start on aggregate. We're not playing well right now. The break, but look, generally speaking, you know, when you've won a lot of games and are 30 games over 500 and all that, I mean, a lot of things are going right. We've scored a lot of runs. Bullpen station's been good. You know, we've been 500 or a game under, been start-stop, and haven't gotten it going. But, you know, we had the most All-Stars in the history of the Braves, and with eight, and that says a lot because the Braves have had Hall of Famers and a lot of great players. So, you know, 2023 has been the year that we've had the most ever All-Stars, which, you know, leads to a really good team and a good product. And, you know, things have gone well, but I've said this many times. I mean, it's only we're only two-thirds of the way there. It's important, and hopefully, which I never want to take for granted, you know, it's what kind of shape are you in when you get there? Are guys swinging the bats well? Is the rotation sharp? Are they on point? Is your health good, your bullpen? So it is a grind. It's a long season. But, yeah, it's been a great two-thirds for us.
And, of course, you know, the 2021 version of your Braves, you learned well. You just got to be peaking at the right time. You go to the World Series and win it that year with, you know, not as strong a record as you guys have right now. So that's a component of it. I'm curious, Alex, how – where you guys are in the standings affected and the gap you have there affected, you know, maybe what you were looking to do at the trade deadline, and maybe more so than that, how you handled the deadline, knowing a couple of big pieces like a Max Fried later down the line, maybe Dylan Lee and Kyle Wright, that those guys could be coming back later. How did those couple of things affect your deadline aggressiveness or what you were looking to do?
Yeah, so I think the first thing in 21, we were scuffling for 4 months. We had a ton of guys got hurt, Ozuna, Acuna, Ian Anderson, Oscar Anoa, who's in our rotation. Travis d'Arnaud missed the bulk of the year. So we just – and then we had guys having down years that were much better. Danzy Swanson got off to a slow start. Freddie Freeman got off to a slow start. So we just – you know, Max Fried had missed time, got off to a little bit of a slow start. So we had a bunch of – really good players that were hurt. We had a bunch of really good players that got off the slow starts. So we knew there'd be a regression with the guys that were had health, that they were going to play better the last third. We felt that way. We had a bunch of guys that were coming back from injury as well that were certainly going to help us quite a bit as well. And really, you know, we played the last 2 months of the year going into the postseason. We were 20 games over 500. For that 2 month period. So we were playing like one of the best teams in the game. So we weren't surprised by it. It's just, we weren't playing well because we had so many guys hurt, just a collection of guys the first 4 months. We just needed to hang on and stay close, but we finally had a complete team. We obviously added guys at the trade deadline because we had holes and we flourished for those 2 months and then into the playoffs. Yeah, I think for now, I think the biggest thing is we haven't had as many holes. So there wasn't as much to do. That being said, you still try to improve the club wherever you can. But, you know, a lot of the position player spots were, you know, we have guys locked up long-term and we're committed to them. You know, a lot of spots at the bullpen, like you mentioned, we have guys coming back from the IL. We only can carry 26 guys on the roster, so we're factoring in that Fried, like you said, is coming back into the rotation. Dylan Lee's coming back. A.J. Minter was coming back. So we just had to be, you know, the bar for us was high to add. And we felt like we needed clear upgrades in certain spots. And look, it was a more challenging trade deadline because there were fewer sellers. But I think because our club had gotten off to a good start and we had so many guys committed, we were going to need clear improvements over some of our top-end guys to make a move.
Alex, you mentioned the fact that you have long-term commitments out to a number of position players. When you look at where this team is at on the position player side now, of course, I understand that some of, you know, hey, you give out a bunch of longer-term deals. It's a matter of pooling risk a little bit, and you hope enough of them hit long-term. Now, you can also look, and over the last couple of years, you've had basically – you know, with a couple tweaks, the same core. Are you starting to see some benefits of, hey, these guys have played together for a while and there's a collectivity there? You know, I know at points in your GM tenure with Toronto, there was a lot of aggression. There was a lot of tinkering out of necessity. But with this Braves group, are you seeing some value in keeping the same core pieces together for a longer stretch of time?
Yeah, look, continuity is always a good thing. I do think, I know Pat Gillick was big on this, you know, trying to turn over the roster each year. He talked about 20%. Now that's only five players when it was 25 and so on. So it's not, I mean, I think you're going to have that. It was just to keep it fresh. But, you know, the players that we signed, we didn't do it strictly for continuity. I mean, we did it. It was player specific, right? Mm-hmm. We believed in these guys. We thought they were going to be good. We thought they worked hard. They were going to age well and so on. And then, you know, I even look back to Toronto, you know, some worked out, some didn't. We signed Adam Lind, Aaron Hill, Romero, Moro, Jose Bautista, Yunel Escobar, Edwin Encarnacion. Those are the ones that off the top of my head that we signed to long-term deals. And, you know, some were fantastic. Some didn't go as well. But I think at the end of the day, we had various reasons to do it for all those guys. We believed in all of them. And, look, if you have continuity and these guys stay healthy and they continue to perform great, I think you want to get into, you know, the practice of signing guys long term and then trading them, right? So I think it's, you know, we're very selective, even though we don't give out no trade clauses and so on. We're very selective that if we sign you to a long term deal, you've agreed to stay here and be with us. And I felt this way in Toronto as well. You know, we signed Jose Bautista to a long term deal, and I was approached early on about some really big trades for him. And even though he didn't have a no trade clause, you know, there was an understanding there that, look, he signed to be in Toronto. He wanted to be here. And unless something out of the ordinary came up, we were going to honor that commitment and keep him. And I've taken that same approach with the Braves.
Well, that worked out pretty well with Jose Bautista. And I did want to speak to you about Jose Bautista. He's joining the Toronto Blue Jays level of excellence this Saturday down at Rogers Center. Now, you were the assistant general manager when the Blue Jays first acquired Jose Bautista for a player to be named later, late in the 2008 season. Do you remember at that point in time, obviously we know what Jose Bautista would become, but it took a little bit, even when he joined the Toronto Blue Jays, for him to become the Jose Bautista we all now remember. Do you have a recollection of what it is you guys liked about Jose Bautista and identified in his profile to where August 2008 you're like, hey, let's kick the tires on this guy, let's see if we can get more out of him?
Yeah, and I remember it really well. So it was in August, the trade deadline had passed, and it was you know, Scott Rolen had gotten hurt, and you know, Scott Rolen had still had issues with his shoulder with us, and we still had to watch him in and out of the lineup and so on. And, you know, we didn't have the protection at third base. And, you know, Jose was an everyday player for the Pirates. But at the time, we didn't view him as a frontline guy. We used to see him a ton in spring training. J.P. Ricciardi always liked the way he played in spring. We played the Pirates a ton in training, so we had a lot of familiarity with him. We saw him a ton. J.P. always liked the player. And Rolen had gotten hurt. I remember he came through what were then called as trade waivers at the time. As the assistant GM, I'd get the waivers and I'd review them and so on. And I remember calling Tony LaCava, our other assistant GM, and saying, hey, Jose Bautista's on trade waivers. What do you think? You know, Rolen's hurt again. It's nice having that. He's arbitration eligible. It's nice just having that protection. We don't know what Rolen's health and durability is going to be going forward. We always need somebody to fill in at third, and he could cover us in other positions, and we've seen him good. And we liked him. He had on-base skills, and I think actually at the time that we got him, we had no power on that 2008 team, I believe. I think he actually immediately led our team in home runs when we acquired him. And I asked Tony what he thought. He said, no, I think you're right. I think it's a good idea. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to go present it to JP. And I went, I brought it to JP, and he's like, oh, yeah, I like Jose. Good idea. I've seen him a lot in spring. That makes sense. You know, feel free to contact the AGM of the Pirates and see if you can get a deal done. And obviously JP was going to have to approve it, but so he gave me free rein, and he was great. JP was great that way. He gave you a lot of rope, a lot of autonomy. Huge part of my development as a GM. And he gave me a lot of opportunities to negotiate contracts and be able to get exposure to trade. So I dealt with the assistant GM of the Pirates at the time, and went back and forth. And Robinson Diaz was the guy they asked about, which seemed fair. And, you know, Jose had been optioned. He was in the minors at the time. So I went back to JP, and I said, look, Diaz is the ask. Seems fair. What do you think? And he said, yeah, you know what? I'm fine with that. Go ahead and complete the deal. We got the deal done, and we didn't think anything of it at the time. And he played. He was solid for us. We actually tried to sign him to a two-year deal that winter or that spring training. He turned it down. Did not have a good 2009. I mean, a terrible 2009 until the end. So I remember talking to him about it. I remember talking to Jose about it, saying, curious. You know, he's a utility guy. He was not playing. He's like, look, I just really believe in myself. I think I'm better than I've played. I understand it's guaranteed contract and so on. And look, he was heading down the barrel of being a non-tender for us. It did not go as according to plan in 2009. And then only when Alex Rios was let go to the White Sox, Jose, because we had no one else, got every day at bats. And then he had a monster September. He had nine home runs. The next year, he goes crazy, and we sign him, and where we are today.
I mean, the 54, yeah, the nine home runs in September, including six over the last eight games in 2009. I remember, you know, strictly as a fan at that point, being excited about it and wondering if it was real. And then the next year, you know, he goes and hits what's still a franchise record, 54 home runs, leads the league in just about every offensive category again in 2011. And then, you know, I know you were aggressive over those years trying to strike, and you know, the team didn't get back to the playoffs, but then 2015 rolls around and everything kind of clicks into place with one of the most fun trade deadlines and second halves of the season ever, really, for the Toronto Blue Jays. When you look at that tenure as with the Blue Jays, your time as GM, the kind of Jose Bautista era, do you have any favorite Jose Bautista memories from that stretch?
You know, there's so many. You know, and I'll tell you this, Jose's, you know, when I took over for the 2010 season, at the time we were going young. Roy Halladay gets traded. We're accumulating all these draft picks. We're signing international free agents. We're going young. We're going into a rebuild or a retool or whatever we called it then. And he has a monster year. He hits the 54 home runs. He now has a year left of club control at 30 years old or 29 years old. And he didn't time. This wasn't part of the plan, right? We were going to get a bunch of 20 to 22-year-olds and start over. And now we have this guy that just has a tremendous year. He's a year away from free agency. You don't know if you believe it or not or if you're buying it or not. And ultimately, we bet on him to sign him long-term, which changed the trajectory of everything. It just accelerated things, for better or worse. But it all of a sudden, it accelerated things because we had an elite player. But look, there was a time where we were not convinced we were going to be able to sign him. Vernon Wells was still on our books. He had a year left. We were headed down. We were in the arbitration hearing room. But I can tell you, we explored trades for him, not because we wanted to trade him, just because we explored signing him, and it looked like it just wasn't going to work. We weren't going to get close to a deal with him. And we wanted to see what the alternatives were. So I remember talking to Paul Beeston and going up to Rogers and just preparing everybody to look like, if we can't sign this guy, he's a year away from free agency, and if we can get a great deal, you know, we have to explore it. And everyone, they understood, on board. But I'll tell you this, Paul, to his credit, was completely uneasy with the thought of him being traded in any scenario, but he understood from a baseball standpoint, if there was a deal we couldn't refuse, we had to go down that path. Obviously, we never found that deal. We ended up signing him. You know, we traded Vernon. That freed up the money. People then assigned him because we couldn't afford Vernon and Jose at the time, having both players on big salaries. And when he hit the 50th home run, same day, it was September 23rd. My wife was induced. I was at the Hospital Sinai. We had to walk. And I remember he hit the home run, Felix Hernandez, Seattle, 50th home run. My daughter was born the next day. I remember that really well. And obviously the bat flip, I'm always going to, you know, that's just a moment. I'm proud of the fact that I was a part of it. I got to see it. I was at the ballpark. I'm one of the people that I can actually say I was there, and people would believe me. So, you know, it's one of those things that it's but, you know, I'll tell you this, and I texted Jose when he got the honor and so on. And I, you know, knowing Jose, I feel like as well as I do, this means a ton to him. I mean, the world to him. He loves Toronto. He loves Canada. I think it's the one place he was really beloved, really treated exceptionally well. I think this means so much to him, be acknowledged. And I think the fan base and the support that he has, I'm just, you know, I'm so excited for him. He deserved it. And he brought so much credibility to the organization. I mean, led every all-star and fan votes and so on. I felt like he put Toronto back on the map for that period of time and was a true superstar that we hadn't had in a long time.
And as someone who was not in the media at that time and was just a fan, it was a huge injection on that side as well. So this weekend should be a lot of fun to look back at that, and very glad to hear it means so much to Jose. Alex Anthopoulos, thank you so much for taking the time out this morning. I really appreciate it.
Really glad to do it.
Alex Anthopoulos, general manager and president of baseball operations for the first place Atlanta Braves, also the assistant general manager when the Toronto Blue Jays acquired Jose Bautista back in 2008, the general manager when they signed Jose Bautista to a long-term extension that would see him set the franchise record for home runs in a single season with 54 back in 2010, followed up with another season, arguably a better season in 2011, even though he didn't hit 54 home runs. He had 43, which still led the league. Also led the league with 132 walks, 24 of them intentional, and led the league in slugging, OPS, OPS+. Came Only third in MVP voting that season, though, behind Jacoby Ellsbury and Justin Verlander, in large part because that Toronto Blue Jays team was 81-81 and finished fourth in the AL East. That's kind of the cost of being a phenomenal player on a not-so-great team. Now, there's a no great pivot out of that because the Toronto Blue Jays are in a very different situation this year. They're not headed for 500. They're 14 games over 500. They are in a playoff spot right now, and they've won four in a row, including last night against the Cleveland Guardians. Madison Shipman was on Blue Jays Central for that game. She joins us now. Madison, how are you?
I am good. How are you doing?
I'm well. Gotta ask. I know we texted a little bit about it yesterday, but you're a big kicks person. I know people can't see this behind the desk on Blue Jays Central, but your thoughts on Alex Bregman of the Houston Astros rolling up to the White House in good kicks when everyone else is in dress shoes?
I know you and I are on the same page, and shoe game was very strong for him yesterday. And yeah, you're exactly right. Nobody can see what's going on with the footwear behind the desk, but usually my shoes are always matching whichever power suit I decide to wear that day. So I did bust out some new ones yesterday. You missed out on seeing those in person, but I might have a few more colors that I'll show throughout the rest of the season.
No Blue Jay Central for me this week, so I'll have to take your word for these ones. Madison, so you're on the Blue Jay Central. You're in the studio with Jamie yesterday. You're breaking down this game, and you see Hyunjin Ryu through 3 1/3 innings. He's been perfect so far. Okay, he walks a guy, but things are going so well. And then that comebacker happens. It hits him on the inside of the right knee. He's able to make the play, but has to come out of the game after four innings. Prior to the injury, what had you made of Hyunjin Ryu's second start back and the progress he'd made off the first one?
You know, I thought he looked really good. He was looking really strong, and I thought it was an improvement from his first start just a few days ago, where he was almost too good with his command. And that's something that he's always been known for, is his command. He's going to bring the ball into the strike zone. But what I felt against the Orioles is that he was leaving it a bit too much over the heart of the plate. I believe it ended up being just over 13% of his pitches were basically middle against the Orioles. And I think he came out yesterday and made some good adjustments, working more of the perimeter of the strike zone, working those edges, because if you're missing too much over the plate, it doesn't matter how much those pitches are moving. That's when people are going to start to make adjustments on them. So I did think that he did make an adjustment with his pitch locations yesterday, and his velocity might be down a little bit on his fastball, but the spin rate is actually up quite a bit. His curveball looks good as well. So him being able to move in a variety of those different pitches, I thought he was really on a roll, seemed to be finding himself out there on the mound, seemed to have a lot of confidence. There were a couple of hard hits in there, but that one off of the knee, it looked like pretty incredible that he was able to jump up off the mound and make the play. But you could tell that he was just in an excruciating amount of pain when he did finally hit the ground after making that play. So hopefully for him, it's nothing too crazy. I hope that he's able to get back out there on the mound, especially after the Tommy John recovery. He's starting to get back on track, trying to get back into his rhythm, and all of a sudden something like that happens. So hopefully it doesn't keep him down for too long.
It's a tough one. And like you said, coming back off of the Tommy John, and the Jays trying to manage this 6-man rotation right now, you just hope that that's not what kind of resolves it, a Hyunjin Ryu injury. We expect some sort of update today, pregame from John Schneider. Ryu underwent precautionary x-rays after the game last night, but a little too late for us to get an update. So we'll keep an eye on that. I'm sure you guys will be talking about it on Blue Jays Central tonight as well. Ryu comes out of the game. Bullpen comes in and does a terrific job kind of picking the team up and helping keep the game close. Jay Jackson and Yenesis Cabrera and Eric Swanson with a couple of clean innings. Garcia and Meza team up for an inning where they give one up. And then, Madison, we get a Jordan Hicks roller coaster, and St. Louis Cardinals fans and beat people had warned us about this. Some national level people had warned us about this, that Jordan Hicks is electric and he's going to get you out of some jams and he's going to help you win some ball games and he's going to put you in some jams because he can be a little erratic. What is your impression of the Jordan Hicks experience so far?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure Jamie and I were sitting there on the desk watching that, holding our breath a couple of times with those pitches going down in the dirt. But have to say, what a phenomenal job Danny Jansen did back behind the plate, because it is not easy to keep those pitches in front of him, especially when he's throwing when Hicks is throwing with such good velocity, so much break, those pitches bouncing down into the dirt, and you know that the batters on the base paths are just waiting to take their chances on a ball skipping away from him. But there was one play in particular where he slid on his knees to his right, and he actually used his shoulder to try to get around that bounce to keep the ball in front of him. So I was super impressed with the way that Danny Jansen was blocking up those balls back behind the plate. But with Jordan Hicks, I just think it kind of comes with the territory, too, of somebody that throws with their fastball velocity as high as he does. Now, I was surprised that he did go to the slider, as many times as he did. Maybe he didn't feel comfortable with that pitch with the fastball yesterday. But I just kept sitting there thinking, you need a strike in this situation. You go with your heater, you go with your best pitch. And ultimately, he was able to get out of it. Kind of a little bit of luck on his side with that timing violation that ended up kind of working in his advantage. That one was a bit of a surprise. I honestly thought it completely changed the entire at bat, because all of a sudden you go from being on the ropes, not being able to find the strike zone, then you're given a strike, and all of a sudden you have the advantage in the at bat. And to Jordan Hicks's credit, he took full advantage of that and ended up getting out of the jam. But yeah, I got a bit tight down down the stretch there. We were holding our breath a little bit when he was out there, but ultimately ended up getting the job done.
He sure did. And then on the other side of things, you know, Kevin Biggio coming through on both sides in the eighth inning, helping Meza get out of that jam Garcia had kind of gotten them into, and the two-run home run that preceded that. Madison, when you see someone who's been relegated to basically role player status, I think that's fair to say of Kevin Biggio at this point and where he fits on this team. When a player in a spot like that who isn't getting a lot of starting action, isn't getting a lot of playing time, comes through twice in a short span like that, how big of a boost can that be to a clubhouse? Because we know that Kevin Biggio is well-liked. We know that Davis Schneider was kind of the guy giving them a boost over the weekend. And yes, it's the time of year where you probably shouldn't need the boost. Everyone should just be locked in and you win for the sake of winning. But it does seem like, you know, once again, a night where the Jays maybe didn't have it, Biggio gave them a shot in the arm. How important are these kind of, not out of nowhere, but less expected performances from guys further down the depth chart this time of year?
I think it's huge for this team, because you're not just getting production from the same people every single day. And there are going to be days where the pitcher is going to have a certain hitter's number, and that's okay. That's just the game of baseball. But being able to have somebody like, in that Red Sox series, Davis Schneider step up the way that he did, and Kevin Biggio step up last night, I really do think that it lengthens out that lineup when you're not just relying on the same one or two people every single day. And what really impressed me even more about Kevin Biggio's performance yesterday is it's not easy to get into a good rhythm when you're not in the starting lineup every single day. It's hard to just be ready whenever your name's called upon. But there have been several times this year where Kevin Biggio has been that guy that stepped up when the Blue Jays needed him to. And you just kind of felt that after Gavin Williams came out of that ball game yesterday, because he was pitching lights out for the Guardians on the mound yesterday. When he came out of the game, you could just kind of feel like the offense had a little bit of new life going after De Los Santos, who came into the ball game. And I was surprised that he decided to throw Gavin three straight changeups. And we heard in the interview after the game that Gavin was actually looking for a heater, but he just kept throwing the changeups and he missed and threw one a little bit up in the zone, and Kevin did not miss on that swing. But to be ready in those situations, knowing that you're not going to be in the lineup every single day, but still do your job, get into a good rhythm before the game, and just be ready for those big moments when they do happen, that's what impressed me about the swing. But then to be able to do it on the defensive side of things as well, in the bottom half of that eighth inning, that unassisted double play that he had, that's not something that you practice every single day, but you're reading the speed and direction of the baseball. You're just going off of your gut instincts to make a play like that. And he was able to get the tag and then run over to first base and tag the base to get that double play. It was just huge when it comes to momentum in that ball game. And we talk about it all the time. The energy and the momentum is something that's so important for teams, not just within an individual ball game, but also when you want to go on these lengthy runs here down the stretch at the end of the season. And that win yesterday, you could just feel it. They were facing a pitcher that had all of his pitches working. They couldn't get anything going. They had 12 strikeouts, and then all of a sudden, bang, two-run home run, unassisted double play, and you just felt all of the energy in that Blue Jays dugout.
Yeah, Gavin Williams was pretty tremendous in that one through seven. You mentioned 12 strikeouts. Every single Blue Jay in the lineup strikes out at least once. And a bit of a trend here now of the Jays struggling with those kind of larger pitchers who throw the flat up in the zone fastball that kind of gets in on you quicker than the velocity reading might suggest. So that's something to keep an eye on. Davis Schneider struggled with that a little bit. Of course, we're not going to expect him to average 3 hits a game for his entire career. Madison, as you got ready for this series, what were your Davis Schneider impressions kind of catching up for? I know you did some Blue Jay Central hits over the weekend during the Sox series as well. Your initial Davis Schneider impressions?
Yeah, I really liked, of course, the way that he was swinging the bat. And yes, the results are something that's incredible. And there are not too many people that can say that they had that much success immediately when being brought up to the big leagues. But what I really liked, too, is hearing John Schneider talk about how the Davis Schneider that we're seeing here for the Blue Jays now is the same Davis Schneider that he watched down in AAA. And we hear oftentimes all of us talking about hitters not trying to do too much, not trying too hard, not going up there trying so hard to hit a home run that you end up changing your swing. And when John Schneider said that about Davis, that's what stood out to me, was that he had the same game approach, same game plan up at the plate that he did in AAA, and just transitioned that up to the big leagues. And that's not something that's easy to do, because you get out there on the field, especially at Fenway, and you're just wanting to crank that ball over the green monster. But you have to take a second to really focus back in on your routine and what's gotten you to that point. And I did think that that's ultimately what led to the fantastic results that we saw in Boston, was because he had that great game approach to the plate. And he didn't just pull the ball to the left side, but he hit the ball to center field. He hit the ball to right center. He was hitting breaking balls. He was hitting fastballs. So those are the types of swings and at-bats that you really love to see. And I think that that great game approach was rewarded by him being moved up to that leadoff spot last night. So for him, obviously a tough night at the plate last night, something that pretty much every other person besides Kevin Biggio in the lineup yesterday experienced. But I would love to see him get back to just having that simplistic game plan approach, going up there and reacting to the pitches that he's seeing, because ultimately that's what got him to this point.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun to see tonight. We'll see if he gets another chance in there against Tanner Bibby on the mound for Cleveland. It'll be Yusei Kikuchi on the Blue Jays side of things against a Cleveland Guardians team that is pretty lefty heavy. That's especially true if Jose Ramirez loses his appeal and ends up serving part of his suspension tonight. They did just add Ramon Laureano, but not sure if he'll be activated for tonight yet. So a lefty heavy group against Yusei Kikuchi, who has been lights out from the left side over his last four starts and really for most of the season here. What are you looking for from Kikuchi tonight to continue what's been working so well for him this last little bit?
Well, I'm going to be looking for that high leg kick, because the higher the leg kick after you say makes a really good pitch, it seems like he's really into the flow and his confidence is just bursting out there on the mound. But all jokes aside, I feel like he's had, again, great command of his fastball, in particular up in the zone. And he's got some sneaky velocity, too. You can just tell by the way that people swing at those pitches that it's coming in on their hands a bit quicker than they're anticipating it. And when he's able to locate that both inside and outside on the upper part of the strike zone, and then be able to drop in that slider, which he's actually throwing harder this season than he has in previous season, but that little bit more velocity seems to be working. And then he throws his curveball all over the strike zone. So it's not just going to be a pitch that's going to be located low and inside to those right-handed batters or low and away to the lefties, but he's going to dot it all throughout the strike zone. But it all stems off of his fastball locations. If he can keep those pitches on the perimeters of the strike zone, keep that velocity up there, then you're going to see his confidence and his energy grow and grow and grow throughout the ballgame. And that's something that has really stood out to me in Yusei's starts, really throughout this season, but in particular the last four, just how confident he's been in every single one of his pitches.
And he has been able to limit the walks all season, and he's been able to limit the home runs of late. Four consecutive starts without a home run, which is something that, you know, maybe that's a low bar at times, but it's been something that's plagued him. So that's been really great to see, in addition to everything you just mentioned with the intensity and trusting the stuff and getting all of his pitches working together. Should be a fun one tonight. Madison, looking forward to seeing you on Blue Jays Central again. And, you know, stick your foot out so we can see what the kick game is today.
I know. I'll just have to put it up there next to Jamie when we're up there on the desk so that everybody can get a shot of the shoes that I'm wearing. But thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Madison Shipman of Blue Jays Central and Sportsnet. She'll be on the TV side the remainder of this series, which, if I have my scheduling down correctly, means she'll be back on the radio broadcast with Ben Wagner sometime soon as well. We're going to take a break. When we come back, talk to Andre Knott of Bally Sports Cleveland. We'll continue to tee up the rest of the series, talk a little bit more about Gavin Williams, what the succession plan may be if Jose Ramirez ends up serving his suspension for these next couple days, and the Guardians adding Ramon Laureano to add to the mix here with Canadian Josh Naylor on the IL, and them missing more than a few bats, but they could use a few more. Maybe Ramon Laureano factors in there. Bo Naylor, by the way, big hit yesterday. I know you don't necessarily want to see it against the Toronto Blue Jays, but always good to see the Canadian guys coming through in big spots as Bo Naylor continues to settle in as the catcher of the future for the Cleveland Guardians. We'll take a break. Andre Knott joins us next as Jays Talk Plus continues on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.
Unrivaled insight, analysis, and opinions on all things Blue Jays. Blair and Barker. Be sure to subscribe and download the show on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Jays Talk Plus. I'm Blake Murphy. Jays continue a four set with Cleveland at 7 o'clock tonight. Yusei Kikuchi against Tanner Bibby. Joining us now to help paint the Guardians side of things is Andre Knott of Bally Sports Cleveland. Andre, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. How are you? It's Tanner Bibby, and I'm not doing it to correct you because nobody knew how it was or how to say it until he got up to the big league. So I get it.
Yeah, that is good to know. I'm being sewered by Baseball Reference not having they have the pronunciation guide for just about everyone.
I know. But
good to know. Bibby. So let's start with Bibby. He's off to a pretty good start here. 7-2 with a 3.14 ERA as a rookie. When you look at him and what Gavin Williams did last night, I know it hasn't been the best of seasons for the Guardians in general, but how much have those two young pitchers lent optimism to where the Guardians are eventually going here?
Yeah, a ton. It wasn't the plan coming out of spring training, to say the least. But I think probably by the end of this series, the Guardians will have the most starting pitching innings by rookies this year. I think Oakland is second, and I want to say that like the Dodgers of all teams and Houston are right there, the 4 or 5. It wasn't the plan coming out of the spring. We knew Gavin Williams was one of our top prospects, just drafted recently. And in spring training, I had the chance to actually beat Gavin and Tanner and Logan Allen, who all have been in our rotation basically the whole year. And the team really didn't let them pitch in big league games, but you knew, and because the Guardians have been, you know, they call it the pitching factory or whatever else, they've been one of the better teams in Major League Baseball. And not only finding pitchers, but usually their game plan has been to draft college pitchers and then kind of streamline them and get them to the system pretty quick. And Gavin Williams was the first guy that they got that was more of a big velo guy. As you saw, he was up 98-99 last night. And Tanner Bibby is not the same, but very close. Another young pitcher that can throw 96-97, wipeout slider, really good curve, college pitcher from the West Coast. He's been fun to watch because him and Gavin, and you know, it happens. They kind of play off of each other. They try to one up each other. So after seeing what Gavin did last night, it'll be interesting to see if Bibby can match that. Because like I said, this is not a year that anyone expected the Guardians to use rookie pitchers. I think the original rotation leaving spring training last season gave the team over 720 innings pitched. So far this year, you've only got 209 innings out of those same five guys. So that's really one of the biggest issues for the Guardians, and really the only reason why they still have a small, small chance to possibly win the AL Central is because of these young dudes that they've cultivated in the system that have showed up in the big leagues and not been overmatched.
And it's, you know, it's par for the course for this Cleveland front office to be able to, not in the playoffs every year, but if there's a dip out of the playoffs, it's a short one. You know, going back as far as 2013, they've almost always been in the mix and been around the playoffs. A huge part of that has, of course, been Jose Ramirez as well. We haven't gotten word yet if he's going to win his appeal, lose his appeal, start serving his suspension tonight. I mean, look, the Guardians, as fun as the pitching side's been, the position player side, the hitting side has been a bit of an issue. Even for a three-game window, just how big of a loss is Jose Ramirez to this lineup if he's going to be out for the rest of this series?
Tremendous. I can't talk about any other teams because I don't follow around them as much, but I can't see a guy having a bigger impact. And that goes for the Yankees and Judge as well. Only because Jose means so much to this team, not only with his bat and from both sides, but his defense at third base. I'm not going to say it's Chapman-like, but it's not far behind. His presence, I can just go on and on and on. And obviously, I'm biased upon this, but Jose Ramirez is one of the top two or three players in all of baseball. And I can say that because I've watched almost every one of his at-bats over the last 10 years. I just know the impact that he's had. I watched him come along as a guy that no one knew of. He changes how teams pitch to the rest of the lineup. And not having Josh Naylor for the next 3 to 6 weeks because he has an oblique injury, this team's lineup at times is very similar to a Triple-A lineup. And without Jose Ramirez, that takes away, as I said, one of the most dynamic players in baseball. So the hope is that it's only, two games or a game. The frustrating thing with this whole situation is Jose is a player that's never been thrown out of a game his entire life. So that whole situation makes, the situation is what it is. I don't think, anyone holds it against him. But it is frustrating that you lose one of your best players because of the immaturity and lack of respect that another player has in the game.
Yeah, it's a tough one, and Jose obviously put out through his management and through his translator a lengthy apology, and I think everyone, given what we know about Jose, everyone can take Jose at his word about, that's not him and that's not the example he wants to set and things like that. You mentioned within there Josh Naylor, him being on the shelf right now, he's obviously a guy that Toronto Blue Jays fans and Canadian baseball fans keep an extra eye on the Naylor brothers there. Prior to this injury, he was one of the hottest hitters in baseball for an extended stretch. When you look at what Josh was able to do this year, we've always known the power was there and he's not a high strikeout guy. That's great. But the ability to also hit for a really high average this year, not only 306 on the season, but he spent a month hovering around 400 for an entire month. How much does that change the near-term outlook for just how important to this team Josh Naylor can be when he gets back healthy or even looking ahead to next year?
The coolest thing that happened this season right now, because as you said, the Guardians usually are in the playoff push, and really it's a blessing because they've been close to the playoffs or in the playoffs, almost every year for the last 9 years. But I can tell you the storyline of the season that we already kind of had penciled in since the All-Star game is that, Josh Naylor is finally starting to fulfill what everyone in Canada and the rest of America and the rest of the world has been waiting for him to do. And it was beautiful to watch. Arise went on such a great run down in Miami and was hovering around 400. And we loved it because we were able to put stats up to say, hey, for as great as Luis Arise is, and he is, we have great respect for him in Cleveland after he was in Minnesota and we had to battle him for his first few years in the league. Josh was doing the same thing, but he was doing it, hitting doubles, home runs, and driving in runs. I want to say he's missed the last week of games, and he's still in the top three in most go-ahead RBIs in all of baseball. Number two or number one in that stat is Jose Ramirez. So you just talk about how dynamic the middle of our lineup was. They were carrying a young team, and it's just been really cool to watch Josh. And Josh is slowly but surely becoming a leader as well. And I've had so many conversations with them about the importance not only to be a great player on the field, but to be a great person off the field for his teammates to be around. I just thought we saw the emergence of a true star. So I think for the people of Canada, you have something to be very proud of and who Josh Naylor is and what he has become. This injury is unfortunate, obviously, because he was having a career year. I want to say he may still be. You can look at him. I think he was third or fourth in RBIs at the time of that. And to me, and not to push the numbers guys, but I think RBIs is still an important stat. Some people will tell you it's not, but the guys that drive in runs and score runs is still very important, especially in a lineup where there wasn't a lot of protection because the Guardians came into this season. They went out and got Josh Bell, a switch hitting power guy, to protect Jose. And really our storyline through the last couple of years is who's going to protect Jose Ramirez in the lineup. And by last week before Josh Naylor got hurt, the storyline became who can protect Josh Naylor in the lineup. So kudos to Josh for all the hard work he's put in. One of the cool things that I like telling everybody when people ask me what's made Josh so great this season is that the hard work. I had the pleasure or the ability. I worked in the NBA for a little while for the Cleveland Cavaliers back, you know, when right before LeBron and when LeBron played. And I love telling the story of, like, when I was doing that job, the best, probably three of the best shooters that I ever saw, Ray Allen, Reggie Miller, and Kobe Bryant, and Zydrunas Ilgauskas, you guys will laugh, but look at the numbers. They were like three or four of the best shooters I'd ever seen in my whole life. And it was amazing for me when I would go into Quicken Loans Arena at 3 o'clock before a 7 o'clock game, or 3:30 for a 7 o'clock game. There would be one guy out, Ray Allen would be the only guy out in the court, and it'd be half lit, and he would be making his 400 three-pointers before, before they even had shoot-around. Same with Kobe, same with Reggie Miller, and I tell that story because Josh Naylor has that same type of drive. You get to the ballpark at 2 o'clock, 2:30, he was working on the machine when nobody else is in the ballpark. He's a hard worker, fun kid, full of energy. And loves being Canadian. I can tell you that last night I was sitting by him during the game. And when Jackson came in for the Blue Jays, for a quick second, I thought that was Edwin Jackson. And he looked at me, he goes, I thought the same thing. And he goes, hell, I got my first hit in my career off Edwin Jackson at the game. He said, Sky Dome. And we start laughing, but he's got a ton of pride of being from Canada, and doing what he's doing. I love him. And anytime I can speak upon the impact of who he is and what he is in this community, I will always do that.
That's great. And, you know, younger brother Bo back up with the club and had a clutch hit yesterday. Not a go-ahead RBI, but a good one there too. Before we let you go here, Andre, the Guardians have claimed Ramon Laureano off of waivers. We're not entirely sure if he'll be activated tonight, but where do you see him fitting in? That's a guy who, I mean, the defense speaks for itself, but where can he fit in for this Guardians team?
Because of the injuries and the trades that this team made, they need a couple of veterans. He will, you know, Miles Straw is a gold glove center fielder, but he has zero home runs and about 600, 700, some at bats. So he's going to get a chance to play a little left, a little center field. He'll get a chance to play some right field against left-handed pitchers, defensive replacement. They brought Cole Calhoun in last week, kind of the same deal because of injuries and because of the trades. They just need veterans. And Laureano still has another year on his contract. They will activate him today, and they'll place David Fry on the injured list, who has a hamstring injury. I think this is kind of, I hate putting it this way, but I think they're going to kick the tires to see if he can be their fourth or fifth outfielder, not only in 23, but 24. And as you said, the glove has not been questioned. But they're really right now, and the Guardians are doing something that's amazing in that a year ago they surprised and shocked the world by making the playoffs as the youngest team in baseball. This year, they're still the youngest team in baseball, and they're going through the hardships of what you go through when you're the youngest team in baseball. I think that's okay. I know it's frustrating for Guardians fans right now. You guys will see throughout this four-game set with three left. They may not win all the games, but as you saw last night, they fight, they claw. But offensively, they just are they're a little short right now. So I think that's part of bringing Laureano in. Also, I got to shout out Ernie Clement. I know he's not with the big league club in Toronto, but Ernie Clement became a fan favorite in Cleveland last year. I know he's playing with the Buffalo team in Rochester. Give love and take care of Ernie Clement from our Canadian friends. He is a beautiful human being with just a beautiful way that he goes about life and energy that he goes about life.
Also hitting 350 at AAA, so maybe we'll see him again before too long. Andre Knott, thanks.
Hey. And he can pitch it for you. He'll pitch for you in a pinch if you need it too.
We've seen it. We've seen it this year. Andre Knott, Bally Sports Cleveland, thanks so much for taking the time out.
You got it, brother. Take care. You guys will all be wonderful. Take care.
Andre Knott, Bally Sports, Great Lakes, technically. I keep calling it Bally Sports Cleveland. Bally Sports, Great Lakes. He mentioned something there about RBI, by the way, and I can say as a I don't know, analytics or khaki or whatever. You look at the RBI leaderboard, the top 45 players in runs batted in this year are all league average or better in WRC plus. So I think even though RBI, we've pivoted away from it, it is hard to fake out the RBI stat over 162 games. You can't be, you know, it's not, I'm not sorting by RBI for my hypothetical MVP ballot, but it's hard to be on that leaderboard without being a pretty damn good hitter over the course of the season. I will see if the Blue Jays can be good hitters tonight against Tanner Beebe. The fastball there, 95 slider, curveball, and something we didn't get to talk about there, a pretty vicious changeup to lefties as well. We'll see how many of the Jays put in the lineup. Devang Desai, Jesse Rubinoff coming up next for some tennis action for you from down at the park. Blair and Barker 5-7. They'll also have Jays talk for you postgame. Thanks to Nick, Lance, and Jennifer behind the glass, to Keegan, John Morosi, Madison Shipman, Andre Knott, and Alex Anthopoulos for coming on. Jays Talk Plus back at you tomorrow, 10 a.m. on the Sportsnet Radio Network and Sportsnet 360.